this land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson, your host. We are at thepeoplespeakradio.net, and we are heard on BBS Radio, and we have the great privilege of having with us as guest for this show this evening, Linda Bilmes, who is a full-time faculty member at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, who has testified I don't know how many times about the cost, the financial cost, of the occupation of Iraq before Congress, and who is the author of a tremendous study, a co-author with Joseph Stiglitz, of the $3 trillion war. Linda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David.
So $3 trillion, and in reading the book, I see over and over again very conservative estimates and almost dreamy, optimistic scenarios, and you still end up at $5 trillion. And I hear rumors that you may think it's even higher. All of these numbers sound very different from what we hear on the news. What's the story?
Well, we really do feel that $3 trillion is a conservative estimate because essentially what we did in the book is we simply added up the cash cost of the war. That's the $600 billion that you read about in the newspapers, which is what we have spent so far in operations, with the long-term cost that we have got to pay even if we were to withdraw very quickly. And there are three main types of costs that we still have to pay. One is the cost of taking care of our veterans for the rest of their lives, both providing disability compensation and medical care. Secondly is the cost of military reset, which involves replacing all of the equipment that's been used up and restoring the military forces to their pre-war strength. And third is the cost of paying interest on all the money that we have borrowed, which is all of it, to wage the war so far. And, of course, when you borrow money, you have to pay it back with interest. And then there are economic costs. The way we looked at it, you could either include the interest cost or the economic cost, which include some of the costs the government doesn't pay. And either way, you very quickly find that you are at the $3 trillion number.
And is our costs from Afghanistan included in here as well in your calculations?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to separate out the cost for Iraq and Afghanistan because of the way the government keeps its books. For example, the Veterans Department does not distinguish between where someone is wounded, and the military does not actually break down its accounts, you know, according to the to whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq. The accounts are broken down by items like repairs, and you have to then figure out how many of those repairs are happening in Iraq versus Afghanistan versus in California. So we have tried to estimate what percentage of the costs are attributable to Afghanistan and to Iraq, but it's a kind of a rough estimate. Roughly speaking, about 75% to 80% of the money spent is for Iraq.
But your goal in putting out these figures is to speak purely of Iraq.
Well, our goal is basically to estimate the cost of the conflict. Clearly, we do believe that one of the costs, and we can't really quantify it, but that one of the costs of having spent so much time and effort in Iraq is that we have diverted resources and attention from Afghanistan. And so some of the uptick in violence and the setbacks we faced in Afghanistan are related to our sort of taking our eye off the ball. And when you are trying to understand the long-term veterans' cost, you really have a very difficult time separating out the Afghanistan and Iraq cost, because so many of our troops have been deployed in both places. How can you really determine whether the fact that someone has post-traumatic stress disorder is due to tour number one in Afghanistan or tour number two in Iraq? although officially 90% of the injuries happen in Iraq. So you can understand the difficulty in,
sure,
in disaggregating these numbers.
Sure, but you're trying, which is something that it seems like Washington isn't. And in fact, you sort of accuse them of sort of bad accounting, and you make a distinction between cash accounting and accrual accounting. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Do you think that
the government is just slow on the uptick, or are they trying to hide a little bit of these costs?
Well, it's a combination of both. First of all, you have a very, very poor accounting system in the federal government. Accounting falls into two categories. There is cash accounting and accrual-based accounting. And all companies larger than a corner grocery store are required by law to use accrual accounting. Now, under cash accounting, if you buy a car for $25,000 and you put a $5,000 down payment on it, you basically just count what you've spent this year, which is $5,000. You don't count the fact that you still owe $20,000, and you don't count the fact that you have to pay interest if you take out a loan on the car. So in accrual accounting, you have to list your deferred liabilities, what you still owe. So amazing though it seems, the federal government uses cash accounting, which means that we don't count the long-term costs of things. And this is a particularly bad problem when you are trying to look at the cost of something for which costs go on for a long, long time. Now, wars have long-term costs, particularly this war, where we have borrowed all of the money to wage the war, where the casualty rate in terms of injuries and diseases is extremely high, and where we have taken such a heavy toll on our military forces. So the accounting system in and of itself distorts the picture. But then you have the fact that the government has basically concealed, or due to lack of planning, not planned ahead for some of the costs. In the veterans area, it's a lack of planning. For example, in 2005 and 2006, even as the war was in full swing, they were still using projections from 2001 for how much money they would be spending from before the
right.
war had began, you know, basically due to the kind of ponderousness of the bureaucracy. And in the Defense Department, I think you have the combination of an extremely poor accounting system, and the Pentagon has flunked its financial audit every year for the past decade, and the fact that they have actually concealed the true number of injuries and wounded and people requiring medical care.
Right, and of course, in politics, costs further out than 8 years don't necessarily matter because you pass them on to another administration. But in the other major question I think a lot of people have about this calculation, I mean, you calculate under one more optimistic scenario, $3 trillion, under another view, maybe $5 trillion. But in each case, you're guessing at an end date. You're guessing that at some point the Iraqis stop fighting back. We have sort of what Barack Obama fantasizes about as non-combat troops in Iraq, which I can't envision what that would be, and it eventually we leave. It, you know, by 2017, if I've understood correctly, we leave, whereas obviously, you know, John McCain is talking in terms of 10,000 or a million years. There are those of us who would like to get out this year. How did you decide what end date to set on the calculation?
Well, we used an end date of, we had two scenarios in our book. The first scenario is a kind of best case scenario in which we would have a fairly rapid drawdown of troops, and we would have a shrinking of the scale of the mission of the troops that remain. You know, right now our troops are engaged in a very, very broad mission. They are policing Iraqi neighborhoods, they are training Iraqi troops, they are policing the northern Kurdish zone, they are involved in civil war prevention, they are involved in fighting al-Qaeda, they are involved in constructing military bases, they are involved in protecting refineries and other facilities, you know, there's many things that they are doing. And so, as you know, our sort of best case is that that mission would essentially shrink to a small mission, that we would relinquish some of these roles, and that that would enable a faster drawdown of troops. It is, roughly speaking, a democratic scenario. The second scenario is a slower drawdown of troops, in which we continue to have a sort of a large, full-scale role for the military. Now, in both cases, we terminate all troops in 2017, and we do that because the Congressional Budget Office only budgets out 10 years, so we essentially took their scenarios, which are, by definition, 10-year scenarios, because that's what they always use.
Right. So if we were to imagine that it goes another 10 years, then we add another 10 years worth to all of these costs, and so it could be any number of trillions of dollars.
Well, I mean, absolutely, but I think the point is that even if we were to withdraw tomorrow, we still would owe trillions of dollars more, because these costs are very long term. I mean, for example, the cost of providing disability compensation for World War II soldiers, the peak year was in 1993. And
right.
The peak year for the Spanish-American War for providing disability compensation was 50 years after the war ended. And for Vietnam and the first Gulf War, the amount that we pay in disability compensation is going up every year and is nowhere close to peaked. Now, you know, the first Gulf War only lasted for 4.5 weeks, but we pay $4.5 billion a year in disability compensation for Gulf War I veterans. So these are very long-term costs, and even if we pulled out tomorrow, we are still both morally and financially liable for replenishing all this equipment that's been used up and regrouping the troops and paying for the veterans for the rest of their lives and paying the interest and so forth.
Yeah, and in fact, as you say quite well in the book, regardless of what people think of this invasion and occupation, nearly everyone agrees that veterans ought to be cared for when they come home. So that cost is there. I often send people to look at the website costofwar.com, because you can look at your town or your county or your state, but then I recommend that they multiply that by 10 because of your calculations. I look at the chart on page 31 in your book, and it has this little bar in the bar graph for total operations to date, and then it grows as you add future operations, future veterans costs, social costs, macroeconomic costs, and interests. Plus, there's an addition for Afghanistan. And is that a rough approximation, that people should multiply by 10 to get the true cost, not in taxes, but the true total cost to their town?
Well, you know, I am conservative by nature. I mean, I'm a public finance expert, and so I tend to take a conservative approach. I think that it is realistic to certainly double the cost that you see, you know, because there is absolutely no question that the veterans' costs and military replenishment costs double everything you've seen. Now, beyond that, it somewhat depends on how we finance the war in the future. Right now, we have paid for all of the war through debt. Which means that we have added already around $800 billion to our national debt, and we have added interest, and of course, interest compounds. So, you know, there's interest on the interest. Now, you know, if we continue to finance the war in that way, because we've already paid money in interest, and then there's still a lot more that we owe on what we've already borrowed. And if we continue to borrow for the next however many years we stay, and we continue to accrue interest on that interest, and we don't pay it off, you know, you can very quickly reach a point where sort of the sky is the limit in terms of how much this is going to cost us. And, you know, as well, if you look at some of the economic costs, you know, you begin to, I don't know that I would put it at 10 times, but you certainly begin to find that it's an order of magnitude larger than the kind of numbers you see on some of these websites. But what I'm trying to say is that we have some decisions to make as a country, not only about continuing the war or not, but also about if the decision is made that it needs to be continued in some form, how we pay for it. Because that affects how much we have to pay in the long term.
And this is a question facing our Congress this month once again. We have a related question emailed in. People email questions in to the People Speak Radio, and you can also call in. This is David Swanson, your host at the People Speak Radio, and we are speaking with Linda Bilmes, who is a full-time faculty member at the Kennedy School of Government at the Harvard University and is the author, the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz, of the $3 trillion war. You can call in toll-free with your questions anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494, or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. 877-489-6350, or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and go to the chat room and send in your questions, as has done John from Canada, who asks, Professor Bilmes, is there any hope of using genuine progress indicators rather than gross domestic product? Your thoughts on full cost accounting, including economic, social, and environmental values, and please explain to the ignorant, including myself, what that means.
I am a very strong believer in general in using cost accounting. Cost accounting is an approach to budgeting in which you basically look at the cost of different activities that you do. So, in other words, if you were trying to understand the cost of, say, fighting a fire, you would look at the fact that there are some costs associated with the fire department. There are also costs associated with the police department. There are also costs associated with the utility lines, the electrical grid, the public works department, ambulances, paramedics, hospitals. There's a whole kind of range of costs. On the other hand, not everything the fire department does is related to fighting fires, cost accounting is sort of a different way of looking at budgets. Now, I'm not completely familiar, I can't really tell from that question what the caller is saying in terms of how to apply that to Iraq, but I think in terms of the benchmarks and the metrics that have been used for progress in Iraq, the president has laid out a number of political benchmarks and so forth, the vast majority of which have not been achieved. In addition, by kind of any other measure in Iraq, in terms of the sort of quality of life, you have much lower availability of electricity, of clean water. You have 4 million people displaced within the country. There's no question that quality of life indicators have dropped. And the violence levels have reduced from this year back to where they were a year and a half ago, before they became absolutely at the brink of a civil war. So they kind of have gone from bad to absolutely horrible back to bad. So I think that the benchmarks that we have at the moment for Iraq do not show a great deal of progress.
In fact, January 07, we were promised they'd be met by November, if I recall correctly, and of course they have not been. But in terms of these other sorts of costs to Americans of this financial expense, your book has quite a lot to say. And we're seeing schools and libraries closed at a time when we're spending these trillions of dollars. We have unrepaired bridges collapsing. Here in Virginia, we now have $2,000 speeding tickets as a way to try to make up for a lack of federal funds. We have the National Guard not here, of course. There are all of these a seemingly endless variety of costs when you start to think about this, which you do when you read your book. How do you calculate all of these things?
Well, I think it's a very important point for people to understand that there's no such thing as a free war, and so the war has weakened our economy in a number of ways. We go through some of the economic costs, as you say, in our book. I mean, the economy has been weakened partly because the actual money that we spend in Iraq, the $12 billion a month in cash, a lot of where that money goes is it goes to pay contractors, largely from the Philippines, Nepal, and other places, for very basic operations such as driving trucks and cooking meals and doing laundry and moving people around and so forth, which happen in Iraq, as well as going towards a huge increase in fuel, which is used for vehicles operating in Iraq. And so none of that money stimulates the U.S. economy. You know, a dollar spent to pay a Nepali contractor to cook a meal in Iraq does not stimulate the U.S. economy, whereas a dollar spent to build a bridge in Virginia stimulates the U.S. economy. You know, secondly, as I mentioned, the war has been financed by borrowing, which means that we have added a huge amount onto our national debt pile. And that, of course, raises interest rates, which crowds out other spending in the budget. So we have less money to spend on other things. And we can certainly see that now as we've gone into a recession or close to a recession, that we don't have the kind of room for maneuver that we had in 2001, where as we headed into recession, we had a surplus, so we could spend that money, and we had a mild recession. This time it looks like it won't be so mild because we don't have that kind of wiggle room. Now, in addition, we have the cost of the price of oil. And it's hard to remember now, but oil was $25 a barrel in March 2003 when we invaded Iraq. And the futures markets, which you know what they do is they anticipate growth, they expected that prices would remain in the $25 range for the next decade. Now, they expected that supply would expand to meet demand, but of course it didn't, because one of the reasons is that the war created uncertainty in the region, which reduced supply and reduced the expansion of refining capacity. So this changed the equation, the supply and demand equation. Now, in our book, we have been very conservative. We've only attributed between $5 and $10 of the oil price increase directly to Iraq, but even that alone shifts money out of the pockets of consumers and businesses and into the hands of the oil-producing nations. So in all of these ways, this war has weakened our economy. Now, there's another set of costs, which are what we call social costs. Those are costs that the federal government doesn't pay, but somebody pays it, like the cost of the loss of life, the actual lost economic contribution of losing 4,000 young people. The way the government in civilian agencies, like in food and drug regulation and environmental regulation, they say that the value of a life is $7 million. But the military counts the value of a life, financially speaking, as $500,000. So, you know, but the $7 million is a more of an estimate of what is actually the loss to an economy, to the economy of a young person. So all of these costs, are costs that we've tried to lay out in our book, although, I tell you, every day somebody from somewhere in the country sends me an idea of another cost that we missed.
I can imagine. And one of the costs that you develop in some depth in the book and explain quite well is the cost of caring for injured veterans and how who've been injured in a variety of ways. And what we hear about in Congress is something very different, is the idea that this money that we're spending, that the public treasury is shelling out over and over again, these hundreds of billions of dollars, is for the troops in the field. Now, of course, these costs that you're urging us to take into consideration are costs of caring for soldiers that can't be expended until once they're brought home. But I'm wondering what percentage of this pile of loot actually has anything to do with going to the troops in the field, because you would think, we have the Republicans who simply want to continue this thing and everything's going well, but we have the Democrats almost universally unwilling to stop funding the troops in combat. To try to make sense of that, it might help to put some sort of a figure on what small percentage of this actually has anything to do with funding the troops in combat.
Well, it's probably about between 25% and a third, and but of course the sort of political rallying cry makes it very, very difficult to get any traction on this. But I think one of the reasons that it has been so difficult to sort out how much of this money actually goes to the troops is because the war has been funded entirely by a mechanism called the Emergency Supplemental Appropriation. And I think your listeners have all seen these go by, $87 billion here and $29 billion here and $56 billion here. They keep coming around. And in each case, and we've now had 24 different separate emergency supplemental appropriations to pay for the war, the purpose of this money is supposed to be to fund genuine emergencies. Now, every year, Congress gets a budget cap because the Congressional Budget Office figures out how much money we're going to take in approximately in tax revenue. And based on that, they give a budget cap to Congress. But the emergency money circumvents that budget cap. It busts the budget cap because the theory is if you have something like Hurricane Katrina, which is unexpected, you can't budget for it, right? So you need to go out and borrow money to help an emergency. That's why it's called an emergency supplemental. So arguably the first tranche of the war when we invaded was unexpected, and you could fund it that way. But here we are in the sixth year of the war, still funding all the money for this war through this emergency mechanism, which means that one of the characteristics of funding something this way is that it is allowed to circumvent all the normal scrutiny, the normal checks and balances of the budget process. So the budget experts in Congress, the Republicans and the Democrats, don't actually have a chance to really look in detail at this money and where it's going, which means you have inevitably profiteering, cost overruns, as we've seen, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of tax evasion by Halliburton and so forth because they've been allowed to employ their workers through shell companies in the Cayman Islands. Lots of money on which, to use the Pentagon jargon, they have, quote, lost visibility on. And, many other kind of cost overruns and so forth. And in the last 2 years, these emergency supplementals have been designed in a way that the military has been allowed to put anything for the general global war on terror into them, which means they don't even have to have anything to do with Iraq, actually. So everything, but the kitchen sink is in there. And it really is means that Congress is approving stuff which has nothing to do with our troops.
In fact, we're staring down the barrel of $102 billion up to $110 billion with some pork in there. Let's bring Mike from California into this discussion. Mike, thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you, Professor Billings, for being on the show.
Thank you, Mike.
My question for you actually is, I am glad you put a human value on the cost of this war. I read that you wrote a report or article stating that there were 50,000 wounded American military, and you thereupon got a call from the Department of Defense who asked you where you got those statistics, and you faxed them their own website page. Is that true?
Yes, it is. In fact, it was a very curious situation. Last year, I wrote a report regarding the cost of treating returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was a very, standard academic report, which basically focused on the long-term cost structure of treating returning veterans. So in the process of doing the research, what I discovered is that the Pentagon actually keeps two sets of books. There is one set of books which refers to those who are wounded in combat. In other words, if your helicopter is shot down and you're wounded, you go into that list. The second set of books is for what's called non-combat injuries. So in other words, if your helicopter crashes into a mountain, but it's not shot down by enemy fire, you go onto that second list. Which, obviously, from the perspective of the cost, doesn't matter, because whether you're wounded in routine transportation or you're wounded because you are you know, shot down directly, you know, either way, you are going to receive the same care from the military medical system, the veteran system. You're going to be entitled to the same disability compensation, and, you know, and so forth. So what I discovered is that the way the Pentagon reports things is that if you are killed in combat or non-combat, either way, you appear on the same list. So that 4,000 figure includes both combat and non-combat. But if you are wounded, the non-combat doesn't show up on the list. So there are actually about 30,000 combat injuries, but now, and this is, you know, the same number, but from now, there are about 70,000 non-combat injuries and serious diseases which required medical evacuation from the theater. So, yes, last year when I wrote my paper, which was presented at the American Economic Association, the Assistant Secretary for Health at the Pentagon called me up and said, where did you get these numbers from? And I said, well, you know, we got them under the Freedom of Information Act from your your website. And he said, well, you know, that's not possible. And I said, well, you know, I'll email you your own website. And he said, no, his email was classified, but I could fax him his own website. And he phoned me and my dean at Harvard, and I literally, you know, faxed him his own website. And that was the last I heard of it until a couple of weeks later, some of the veterans groups phoned me up, and they said, have you seen what happened? And I said, no, what happened? And they said, would they change the website? And this was really, you know, a stunning situation, which was the subject of four New York Times articles where they printed the before and after website pictures. Essentially, what the Pentagon did is it changed the way the website looks. So you can still get to that 70,000 number, but you have to add up the numbers from a lot of different columns, so you really need to know what you're looking for. So before, it just had a total at the bottom that said total, what they call them, is non-mortal casualties. But now, in order to get to the total non-mortal casualties, you have to add up, you know, the number of people who were, you know, wounded in combat and not in combat, who were evacuated and not evacuated, and who were, you know, this and that. And, you know, you have to really be familiar with all the terminology and the figures to get to that number. And there's no sort of total at the bottom. And that's that's what there is now. So that was the story. And this was one of the people who was essentially relieved of his duties when Secretary Gates came in after the whole Walter Reed scandal broke.
for accidentally allowing someone to learn something, I guess.
But he did receive, this guy did receive Keith Olbermann's Worst Person of the Year award.
It's stiff competition, I got to tell you, but he may have earned it. I wanted to ask you, I know you can't stay with us forever,
right.
And I wanted to ask you about something that really disturbed me about the past couple of days of questioning of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, because a lot of us have been making great use, we think, of your work, this financial cost. And what people could have done good with the same money is an additional very powerful argument to the other arguments against this occupation. And clearly you are personally opposed to the occupation and would like to see this used as an argument to end it. But what I've seen on Capitol Hill other than the Republicans cheering for the supposed successes in Iraq, is the Democrats trying to outdo each other in demanding that the Iraqis start picking up the financial costs of this expensive endeavor, which I'm guessing was not the policy outcome you were looking for. What do you think of that sort of solution to the financial costs to Americans? Let's make the Iraqis pay for their own occupation.
You know, I think that the problem is that this set of hearings was a set of hearings about the military situation in Iraq. And, you know, what we really need is to have a set of hearings that would essentially lay the financial picture before the American people in the same way. If the president were to come to the public and to say, and this is essentially what Lyndon Johnson did in 1968 when he raised taxes to pay for Vietnam, and this is what Ronald Reagan did in the 80s when he raised taxes to pay for the Cold War buildup, you know, if the president were to come to the public and to say, look, I think this is what we need to do, and here is the tax increase you guys, each household has got to pay. You've each got to pay $2,000 this year because this is the cost per household of continuing this. I think the public could then decide and weigh in about whether or not they felt it was worth it. But right now, it's all being done sort of under the carpet. And it's fine to ask the Iraqis, for example, to subsidize the fuel, which we now pay $3.50 a barrel for in Iraq, considering that they get it there. I think that's fine. But, you know, they obviously do not have the resources to pay the $300 or so billion, which it's going to cost this year to continue to keep this going. And, you know, people don't have a sense of, you know, what am I paying or, you know, of this, because it's all being passed on to the next generation. And this is what is clearly, you know, to me, very frustrating about these hearings.
Should Congress give this president another $102 billion, or should they decline to do that?
You know, I would say that they should use that as an opportunity to have hearings. Serious hearings to really bring to light what this is costing and how it is paid for. You know, do we want to borrow all this money from China, to carry this thing on? And this is, I don't think, a partisan issue. I think it's a good government issue. I think it's an issue of fiscal responsibility. And, so far, no one has really, I think, David Walker, the Comptroller General, you know, has raised this issue, but you know, none of the candidates have really taken on this fight.
I couldn't agree more. Professor Bilmes, I know you can't stay with us all night.
Yeah.
I have about 8 hours more worth of questions for you.
Right, okay, so maybe we could do one more question, and then I'm going to go.
Okay, I will try to make it a good one. In terms of Reconstruction, you suggest in the book that we've actually spent a great deal, including relative to past Reconstruction efforts, and yet we've gotten very, very little for it. What has actually gone to Reconstruction? And then as a follow-up, a lot of money has clearly gone to war and disaster profiteers and cost-plus contracts, you know, all sorts of waste and CEO benefits. Isn't there a benefit there in our ability to sort of live vicariously through the luxury of billionaires that we are enriching? Shouldn't we factor that benefit into our calculations?
Well, let me try and address your question. I think on the Reconstruction, that is one of the truly kind of, you know, one of the many tragedies within the overall tragedy of the war, because here you have a situation where the president went to the Congress, said he had to have the $20 billion. You know, this is a huge amount of money. This is three times what we spent you know, three times per Iraqi what we spent per European in the Marshall Plan on reconstructing Iraq. And Congress was at the time reluctant to go along with it. They said, why don't we loan them the money and so forth? But the president said, no, had to have it. And this is in the summer of 2003. And the president said at the time that this was critical to winning the hearts and minds, that we had to get the electricity back on, the water running, the schools opened, etc. So that money was for basically targeted civilian projects. And the money was passed, became available in October 1, 2003. And due to basically bureaucratic fighting between the Defense Department and Congress, the Congress wanted the Pentagon to put out these bids to competitive bid. The Pentagon didn't want to. It wanted to do sole source contracts to the usual suspects and so forth. Due to, you know, huge amount of fighting as well as the general slowness of the contracting process and the fact that the Pentagon doesn't normally do civilian stuff like this, the bottom line was that by the following spring, almost none of the money had been spent. Even by the following summer, almost none of it had been spent. And by that time, this is now the summer of 2004, the security situation had deteriorated, and we had, many believe, you know, lost the hearts and minds of the people as they saw their country unraveling. Now, you know, over the last few years, you know, there has been a lot of money that has gone into reconstruction, but when you look at where much of that money has gone, so much of it has been siphoned off into just the security for the contractors doing it, security costs, to,
right,
you know, very expensive security contractors, that much, much less has actually gone into the projects that needed to be done. So, you know, it was a lot that was eventually spent sort of too late. Now, a second real problem with all of this is that we have relied to an unprecedented extent in this war on private contractors. I mean, we've never, ever had a war where we've had so many contractors, and we have 120,000 contractors operating in Iraq now. Now, a contractor, no matter how good, is obviously from the private sector, and so their primary objective is to make money and to minimize costs. So when they are going about their contracts, it is in their interest to hire cheaper people from the Philippines or wherever, bring them in and, you know, house them, if that's more cost effective for them, rather than hiring the local Iraqis who are often, you know, less reliable. And because of the fact that they are often targeted for working with Americans, and so you had in 2003 a million unemployed Iraqi men. So even though it was in our national objective to try and find jobs for all of those people, what the contractors were doing was finding jobs for people from all over the world who they brought into Iraq to do these jobs. So it really was and has continued to be a situation where the interests of the contractors are not the same as the interests of the U.S. and indeed the Iraqi governments.
It's an incredible tragedy, and
it is a real tragedy. Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and I hope that you and your listeners all go out and buy the book, The $3 Trillion War, and continue to do what we each can to bring this conflict to an end.
Well, we thank you very much for your time and for your work and for this book. Keep it up. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, and our guest for the past 45 minutes has been Professor Linda Bilmes, full-time faculty member at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, has testified numerous times in front of Congress about the financial costs of occupying Iraq and Afghanistan, and she is the author, together with Joseph Stiglitz, of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, which I highly recommend to all of you. And our guests next week, Tuesday evening, board member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Jason Lemieux. And Wednesday, this same program, same time, our guest will be Pat Elder from the National Network Opposing Militarization of Youth. Pat is a friend of mine, an activist, and a top expert on how to keep military recruitment out of schools. Should be a very interesting show. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. Thanks for being with us.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of that summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you.
Hello, this is Mark O'May. I'm really happy you're enjoying the rich variety of music on bbsradio.com. Please give me a visit at www.marcome.com. Hope to see you.